This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Last year, President Biden started referring to extreme far-right Republicans as ultra-MAGA. It was not a compliment. A few days later, a reporter shouted a question about it to the third-ranking House Republican, New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, being called ultra-MAGA. I am ultra-MAGA. I'm proud of it.
Ultra-MAGA and proud of it, she says there. A surprising turn for someone who won her seat campaigning as a moderate millennial, a Paul Ryan protege with establishment cred. But now she has gone full Trump with nods to QAnon and racist conspiracy theories, embracing his big lie about election fraud. It's helped rocket her to the GOP leadership. She replaced Wyoming's Liz Cheney. But it also alienated her friends and mentors along the way. And that's according to my next guest, New York Times political and investigative reporter Nicholas Confessori. He has written a big profile that is headlined The Invention of Elise Stefanik. Hi, Nick. How are you?
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks. Okay, well, first, before we get into her bio, let's just talk about the latest news and, of course, the speaker battle. She was firmly in the now speaker, Kevin McCarthy, camp. She gave one of the nominating speeches. So I'm wondering, I mean, we're talking about shape-shifting. Is she the female McCarthy?
You know, in some ways, there's a lot in common. You know, Kevin McCarthy has also transitioned from being a somewhat moderate Republican in California and a friend of Silicon Valley to a MAGA Trump person who hates big tech. And, you know, I think you've seen a lot of this. I focused on Elise Stefanik, I think, because her shapeshift here, which is not an uncommon move in the party over the last few years, mm-hmm. is the most obvious example, the most brazen example I think we have of some lawmakers in the GOP who didn't just try to get through the Trump years with their heads down, but decided, I'm going to join what he's doing. I'm going to give up my old ideals and principles because I want to be where the action is in my party. And that's what happened to Elise Stefanik.
Okay, well, let's get a little background on her. In 2014, she is, at age 30, the youngest woman ever to be elected to Congress. And so let's talk about how she got there. How did she get there? She went to Harvard. She grew up in the Albany area, and she worked at the Bush White House and has kind of, successes and failures along the way. And then she catches the eye of Paul Ryan. Why?
Well, I think Paul Ryan, for whom she worked on the 2012 campaign as a debate prep handler, saw her as a young version of himself, as somebody who was, in his mind, principled and pragmatic and in it for the right reasons, thoughtful and a policy wonk. And those are all the qualities that he cares about. And so he brought her along. He introduced her to donors. He raised money for her first campaign. And it wasn't necessarily an easy campaign because up in the North Country, in her district, I think she was not an obvious candidate to the kind of crusty, older male political establishment up there. Mm-hmm. But she was closely embraced by the Bush establishment in Washington, which brought her along, promoted her, got her jobs, got her fundraising help. So when she won the primary for the Republican Party in 2014 in that district, it was kind of all up from there. And when she was elected, she quoted from Lean In. She gave a couple of interviews to talk about kind of why she was in it. And she, branded herself as an aspirational person, hopeful, positive, pragmatic, and bipartisan. And that was how she started.
Well, just to underscore that, I want to play a clip from an ad from her first campaign of sort of her from the before times.
Our next representative must spend every day working on improving our economy and bringing more jobs to the North Country, not playing the politics of personal destruction. Too many people are struggling and government is getting in the way. It's why I've pledged to you, not Washington.
Okay, so she's, goes on saying she's working for you, that she doesn't want to play the politics of personal destruction, as she said there, that she's doesn't want to play this whole game. And now that she's not like that at all. Describe what she sounds like now.
Well, you heard it in that clip you played at the start of the show. I am ultra MAGA, mm-hmm. which is not something that anybody who knows her believes she really believes in. It's a posture. It's theater.
Yeah.
It's theater designed to keep open a line to Trump, who is the ultimate source of her juice in the house and her fundraising ability. It's a line designed to entice and gladden the grassroots fundraising base on the MAGA side of the equation. She basically tweets like Trump. She took all her intelligence, and she's a very smart woman, and all her knowledge of politics and audience and how to do messaging, and she applied that to aping Donald Trump, to becoming as much like him in terms of how she talked about Democrats, how she talked on Twitter, as she possibly could. So now she says things like, and Democrats are, quote, the party of socialists, you know, criminals, communist truth ministers, and media stenographers. This is the kind of red meat that you throw out on Twitter to get engagement and ultimately to raise money. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone who knows her well believes that that's an expression of her true values or the way she really started out in politics. But it is what works to a certain extent in the magnified party that she's now a part of.
I mean, here's this Harvard-educated woman writing purposefully misspelled tweets, to, you know, that she never did before.
Yeah, the random capitalization. Yeah. You know, it's a certain style. And you know, she aped it. She took it from Trump, and she's trying to be kind of a mini-me of his on Twitter.
What was the moment of her conversion? When did she decide this is the road that I need to take?
One of the things we reported in our story that I was really fascinated to learn about from current and former friends and advisors is how unhappy she was in Congress after Trump was elected. You know, she occupied a place that was, you know, fairly safe for her in political terms as kind of a center right, cautious, Trump critic who would vote against him on the tax bill because it was bad for New Yorkers. Who opposed his effort to raid the military budget to build the border wall, you know, and she wasn't, you know, a John McCain maverick type, but she was pretty bipartisan, and she voted against the president on some big things. But what she found was that she just couldn't progress in that environment. Donald Trump, is not a policy wonk. He didn't care that she had the best argument for wherever the policy was. It's not how he made decisions. And what we saw in the House in the end of the Paul Ryan era was this impossibility of governing with the Freedom Caucus and the harder right members of that caucus really making it impossible for Paul Ryan to do a lot beyond the tax cut, which he did succeed on. Mm-hmm. And I think she just got to this point in her personal and professional life where her party was moving hard in a Trump direction. That's where the money and the influence was. And her close friends, her friends from Harvard, the people who were more Bushy or liberal, felt that she wasn't actually standing up hard enough against Trump. And so in her mind, in her world, I think she was getting it from both sides. She was getting attacked by Fox for being a squish on immigration, and she was getting attacked by her friends for not being a sterner attacker of Donald Trump. And there came this turning point, and I really think it happened between the end of the 2018 cycle, when Donald Trump accompanied her on a White House visit, an official visit, I should say, to Fort Drum to sign the defense authorization bill, where she saw that like the power of the presidency was really real, and at that event she saw what could happen if she could harness her own agenda or a piece of it to the power of the presidency. And after that, she really begins to change and distance herself more from her old friends and her old persona. And then all of a sudden, and everyone's, you know, probably remembers this, she became a star player in the first impeachment.
Right.
Defending him. You know, she hadn't been
taking on Adam Schiff.
She became absolutely his biggest defender. She joined his legal team. She played a big role in trying to undercut the Democratic investigation. To cast it all as partisan theater. And that happened pretty late. I mean, she was not a big player on the Republican side of the impeachment run-up. She didn't go to a ton of the meetings or the depositions. And then she just sort of popped out, and right. They kind of needed her. It was valuable to the rest of the party, even the Freedom Caucus types and the MAGA people, was that she wasn't identified as a MAGA person.
Right.
And she was also really good. Like, not every person in Congress can do the stuff that she does.
So we have just a minute left, and I guess I'm wondering if, like McCarthy, she's put herself in a terrible position because she isn't really viewed as a diehard true believer, MAGA. You know, those people kind of look at her askance. And then her old friends don't want her around either. So what happens, especially now that Trump's star is fading? What happens to Elise Stefanik? And we just have a few seconds.
Look, I think that she has harnessed herself to Donald Trump, and sort of as he goes and succeeds or fails, so does she in the near term. Now, I will say she's still quite young by congressional standards, I should
say.
She's 38. She has a long career. She probably has another act if she wants it. But right now, I think we're going to find out if the bet she has placed on tying herself so closely to this one singular figure is going to pay off.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It's a fascinating profile. I urge everyone to go read it. The Invention of Elise Stefanik in the New York Times Magazine. Nick Confessori, political and investigative reporter for the Times. Thanks a lot.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Coming up, how porn shaped the internet, including something so basic like the JPEG.
Someone brought a Playboy magazine into a computer science lab where they were developing image processing techniques. They were trying to figure out how to best do it over the internet.
How sex and the internet are intertwined, next on Press Play.